Welcome to the Legal Academy, a podcast about law professors. I'm your host, Oren Kerr, a law professor at the University of California at Berkeley. This is an interview-based show in which I'll interview leading law professors about the Legal Academy. We'll cover topics like legal scholarship, teaching law, university service, and everything else that law professors think about. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to the Legal Academy, episode 15. My guest this week is Brian Leiter, the Carl Llewellyn Professor of Jurisprudence and Director of the Center for Law, Philosophy, and Human Values at the University of Chicago Law School, where he has taught since 2008. Brian began his career at the University of San Diego Law School before moving on to the University of Texas at Austin in 1995. He's been a visiting professor at Yale and Oxford, among other places. And he is, of course, one of the leading scholars of philosophy and jurisprudence, particularly widely known in the legal academic world for following the world of law professors through his popular blog, Brian Leiter's Law School Reports, and his law school rankings. I think everybody who's watching or listening to this show knows who Brian Leiter is. You're well known, Brian, in the world of the meta law professor world, for lack of a better phrase. So welcome to the show. It's really great to have you.
Thank you, Oren, and thank you for doing this whole series. I've enjoyed watching a couple of the earlier episodes, and I hope I'll be as helpful as some of your earlier guests.
I'm absolutely sure you will. So I wanted to start with the question of trends in the hiring market. So one of the themes we've talked about in prior episodes is how the academic market may be changing in terms of what schools are looking for or hiring patterns, and I was curious if you had a take on, in the last 10 years or so, how things have changed at both entry level and lateral levels.
Yeah, it's hard to comment on the lateral, so I'm going to just put that to one side for the moment, and maybe we'll find a way to get back to it. I think the two big things on the entry level market in the last 10 years that I have noticed, and I should mention, is I also work with Chicago alums on the law teaching market. So I get a kind of insider's perspective from watching what happens with our different candidates, not just our alums, but also our Bigelow Fellows. You had Emma Kaufman, a former Bigelow Fellow, on. So that's given me a useful perspective. And here's the two things that really leap out at me from the last 10 years. The first is that it's almost unheard of now for someone with only a JD and no fellowship and no postdoc, no VAP, to get a tenure track job in law teaching. You had Sarah Lawski on, I know, a few weeks back. And so if I'm recalling correctly from her data from last year, there was maybe one person who was a mere JD, that is, didn't have a PhD, didn't have a VAP, didn't have a postdoc, who got a tenure track job. It was actually one of our grads, and I was very pleased for him. You know, he had certain advantages. He was kind of a full service business law curriculum, and business law is always in demand. That is not a change. That's been true every year since I've been in the Legal Academy. But it's really remarkable, right? Because even 10 years ago, that wasn't true. And 20 years ago, it wasn't true at all. As you know, because you've lived through this too, I think I probably was in the academy a few years before you, but not that many years. You know, when fellowship programs first started, they were actually aimed at people with JDs who were smart and had potential, but needed an opportunity to write. And now fellowships are offered hiring JD PhDs, or almost all of them expect you to have writing before you even get into a fellowship, right?
It seems like the hiring for the prestigious fellowships is just sort of replicating the entry level tenure track hiring, right? It's sort of, they're looking for the top candidates, and then the top become even more top and more prepared.
I agree with that that characterization. That has clearly been the pattern. And the need to have some kind of fellowship if you don't have a PhD has become well, as the stats I was just mentioning point out, it's become almost essential. Right? It's become almost essential. Now, why is this? One possibility is just a mindless credentials arms race, right? And I think there's an aspect of that. But I think what's really driving this is that hiring in the 27 years now since I was first on the law teaching market has become much more focused on the writing that candidates have done. And therefore, you really need to have writing and more writing and more writing. My general rule of thumb for our candidates, our alumni, is you want to have one post-law school publication and a job market paper. There are people who succeed without that, but they are the exception, not the norm, right? Now, that's not so simple to do, right? If you went straight from law school, did a one-year clerkship and then went into practice, right? So because the law schools want to see writing, right? The demand for, now people do a PhD, right? They've been doing a lot of writing, right? Someone who comes out of a PhD program without a lot of writing to show, that's already suspicious, okay? And then for those who didn't do that, the fellowship provides the opportunity to refine, polish, develop your writing, and now you have a good bit of writing to show hiring schools. So that's been, I think, the big change that started about 20-odd years ago. And it's also, there's something else going on, which is curious. Now, I haven't, the Faculty Appointments Registry, for you know what it is, but for the benefit of the audience, just came out today with this year's people on the law teaching market. I don't know how many candidates are in it. I only saw this about 20 minutes before we started. But, last year was the lowest number of candidates in, I would venture with some confidence, the last 25 years. There were under 400 candidates in the first Faculty Appointments Registry. The trend has been downward for quite some time. Again, Sarah Lawski has been very helpful in compiling this at various intervals. In the late 90s, I chaired appointments in Texas a little over 20 years ago, and there were 1,000 resumes in the first FAR. But the thing was, about 500 of them or more were non-starters. That is, they were people who just kind of threw their hat in the ring, on a fluke. Those people have almost entirely disappeared. It's partly the internet. It's partly that there's all this free advice out there, of which your series is now adding to it, so the candidates have a better sense of whether it's really worth, paying the fee to enter the FAR when you don't have any writing and you've been in practice 8 years, you've not done any writing, and you're applying for academic positions. So there's been a change on the supply side that's very striking. And it's partly because candidates get the message that in order to be competitive, they've got to have more scholarship than was true 20-odd years ago.
Yeah, it's fun. I went on the entry-level market 20 years ago, as you say. And it did seem like it was more of a free-for-all in a way that struck me as irrational, in that schools were giving tenure to the overwhelming majority of candidates. And yet, to become a law professor, it was just like, write an article and go on the teaching market. Anyone could do it. And it was, I remember at the time thinking like, wow, this is amazing. Like, I can't believe this happens. And so there's some aspect of the professionalization of the process that has struck me as a very rational response to an outrageously great job that was unusually easy to get. I don't know if that's the explanation, but maybe that's the explanation. I'm curious. Do you see that trend continuing of just more and more credentialing being required and more of a lead-in required to get the initial job?
Short answer is yes, and I think partly it's because, especially because the other thing we've seen more of over the last 10 years, besides the fact that people without a PhD have done a FAP or a fellowship, is that we see more and more JD PhDs who invariably bring that perspective to the job market. Right? They want to see, because again, in other parts of the academic job market where people have done a PhD, right, and then apply for jobs, hiring schools have an enormous amount of information. They have letters of reference from people who actually know these candidates really well, if they're responsible, right? And they have a lot of writing, right? I mean, there's just a lot. The candidates have typically had teaching experience, right? So there's a lot of front-loaded information in other academic job markets. In law schools are gradually moving in that direction. And I think one consequence of that is that we will see less of what was very distinctive of the law legal academia, which was the upward mobility that was possible, right? And I'm not even thinking of myself. I mean, I started San Diego, but as you know, San Diego is a little unusual for a regional law school. That is, they've, you know, been pretty academically serious. They hire ambitiously and so on.
Yeah.
But, you know, Jack Balkin, who's at the Yale Law School, started at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Right? George Priest, who's at the Yale Law School, started at what was then the University of Puget Sound Law School, subsequently bought by Seattle. Patricia Williams, who just retired from Columbia, started at Golden Gate University in San Francisco. Right? This is dramatic upward mobility, right? And I think the explanation for it is because there were lots of false negatives in the old days because schools just didn't have that much information about the candidates, right? My guess is we're going to see somewhat less of that because there's more front-loaded information now because of this trend that we've been talking about. But, you know, we'll see. There's still going to be some of that. But that kind of upward mobility is extremely rare in other academic fields. You don't see people who start at, you know, a small state school that just has undergraduates ending up at the top PhD granting programs. Very, very rare. Whereas in law, you know, it had been for a long time very, very common. I seem to recall Lon Fuller started at the University of Nebraska. and gradually made his way to Harvard and fame, as it were. So we'll see how that plays out in terms of the lateral market. We may see less of this dramatic upward mobility and sort of, you know, moves by stages, right? That is, you know, George Priest didn't go directly from Puget Sound to Yale. I think he had to make a stop at UCLA on the way.
Yeah.
This
always struck me as one of the less rational parts of, well, I don't know how much of legal academic hiring is ever all that rational, but the sort of tendency of schools to look a little bit below themselves and figure, well, if a candidate has been kind of pre-approved by a somewhat lower ranked school, but still in the ballpark, then they must be better. they're vouched for by another faculty, I guess.
I think that's roughly is what's going on. It's related to a feature of the rookie market that we see every year, which is that, you know, my uncharitable way of putting it is that law schools, you know, especially top law schools, you know, are like lemmings chasing the same one or two candidates off the cliff, right? That is, law schools surprisingly, you know, I often lack confidence in their own judgment, so they need reinforcement. They need the reinforcement of knowing that, oh, he had an offer from Northwestern, so we can consider him too, right? And that's a curious feature of this, of the law teaching job market. Again, very rare in academic philosophy. Partly there's just the job market is always tighter. Every once in a blue moon, there's a candidate who gets offers from all the top 10 departments. But then there's usually like a good reason for it. It isn't the quite same, you know, now we believe our judgment. But, you know, philosophers believe in their judgments. That's a separate story. But law, I've been struck by that for years, how much law schools need reinforcement. I mean, years ago, I'll give you an example. This, you know, because you're familiar with Mitch Berman, of course, because he does some work in criminal law theory. Texas was the only school that made him an offer 22 years ago. You know, and since then he's had Michigan come calling and Northwestern, and he ended up moving to Penn, and, you know, he's done been very successful. I was chair of appointments, that probably helped him. And you know, and he had writing that was extremely good, right? But that kind of situation is weird. You know, Adrian Vermeule, I believe, had two offers. One was Chicago and one was your former school, GW, or former school twice back, as it were. But more common is, you know, schools get, they all get focused, and then, you know, all of a sudden they're all competing, you know, for the same, you know, candidate. And you
with a close attention to the U.S. news ranking of the other schools that are interested in the candidate. It's very, it's sort of the high school, it's the high school aspect, I guess, of legal academic hiring.
There's a certain amount of that, right, is who's popular. But I think at root, it's that, you know, people, they need to be reassured that their sense that, you know, Jane Doe is really very good. Oh, they think she's really good too, right? So we must be right.
Right.
So just budge my lights. So I'm going to readjust it here.
Not at all. So that actually brings up the question of mistakes that schools make. So if you're on an appointments committee or a chair of an appointments committee at a school, and you're trying to assemble the best scholarly faculty you can, what are some of the mistakes that you think schools make in doing that? Or what are the, you know, best practices that you would recommend to an appointments chair to follow to get those great scholars?
Yeah. Well, so my recommendations on this score are going to be a little bit idiosyncratic, right? So I have a general rule that I discount a reference from anyone I wouldn't hire. I also have a pretty short list of recommenders that I consider to be credible recommenders. And I think it's very important for schools to each develop that based on their own experience. Because again, I'm sure you know this from you've done hiring, I imagine, at GW, and you're of course on appointments now. You know, there are recommenders out there who, shall we say, are not credible, who never met a candidate they didn't love. Many years ago, I was speaking with a senior member of the Yale faculty who shall go nameless. And I pointed out that Yale had sent us their folder of their candidates, 40 CVs, you know. And I said, look, I said, I need to know who among these is really a serious candidate. And this person said, they weren't kidding you, they said, they are all wonderful. But they weren't all wonderful, right? In fact, about half of them, you know, were quite weak. And, you know, maybe two or three of them were worth taking a serious look at, you know. So I think it's very important that schools, you know, you have to develop from experience a sense of who is a reliable reference and who isn't. You know, the other thing is you've got to constitute your appointments committees with people who have judgment. There's no nicer way to put that. You know, take regional schools that do very good hiring, junior hiring, like San Diego is one. It's got better since I left. I don't know if that's cause and effect. Florida State is another very good example, right? Florida State, you know, is regularly rated by top 10, top 15 law schools because they have such good judgment about rookies.
Yeah, great faculty.
And what's the key to their success? The key to their success is they had some people there initially who had pretty good judgment, and deans had the sense to invest them with power on appointments committees, right? And that's the only way, you know, schools can both maintain their quality or improve the quality of their faculty, is if you are in judgment to people who, sorry, I realized I had my email open. you've got to have people who have, you know, good judgment about these things. Now, you have to tell me the answer to this. I have heard George Washington has an elected appointments committee.
They had a formally elected appointments committee, but it's actually the dean assembles it and then it's put before a vote. So
I see. Okay.
At least back in the days, it was like, no one was going to be like, I reject this proposal. So it's effectively.
Got it. Okay. So it is dean appointed. Okay. I once heard it was elected, which struck me as mad, right? Because, there's no guarantee. There's very few faculties where you could be confident that an elected appointments committee would represent the people with good judgment, right? Because that's how faculties are, right? People have their friends, the schmooze factor, affects things and so on.
Do you have a sense of whether schools that are committed to hiring top scholars generally can do so, where there's the problem is the will, not the getting of them? Or is it just really hard to identify the top people? And the reason what this comes to mind is actually you play a role in this. I'm always interested in your list every year of the top 10 moves that got people talking, or that were considered kind of a coup, that sort of top hire. And sometimes I'll know the people that are on that list, and happily I've sometimes been on that list, but when you talk to people that are on the list, usually their experience is not like, oh, I've always had so many offers and this year I decided to pick one. Usually it's like, yeah, I was sitting at my school and I never gotten an offer. And so that does raise the question of like, are schools, is what's keeping schools from assembling a top faculty in the way that some of the schools you've mentioned done? Is it just that they're not that focused on scholarship as compared to all the other things that are competing issues, or do you have a sense of that question?
So I think the problem is usually that they're not very good at evaluating scholarship or scholarly potential. Now, and I'm not talking about Berkeley or Chicago here, right? I mean, there's 200 accredited law schools out there. This is why places like Florida State and San Diego stand out, is they're actually, you seem to be unusually good at it. Right? I am struck, I think a lot of schools are not so good, either because their appointments committees weren't well constituted. The truth is appointments committees have an enormous amount of influence at all law schools. Even at law schools where the faculty sometimes votes down an appointments committee recommendation, the appointments committee still sets the agenda, right, as to who even gets on the radar. And this is why the constitution of the appointments committee is, one of the dean's most important responsibilities. If you constitute your appointments committee poorly, you will have poor outcomes. That's pretty much guaranteed. other than, there's always, every year there's going to be a couple of people who are obviously safe bets, right? But the problem is the people who are obviously safe bets are going to have lots of offers, right? So they're not going to come to your state flagship, that isn't Berkeley or something, right? They're going to have other offers. They're going to go elsewhere. So the real talent is to be able to read people's writings and assess potential based on an informed judgment, right? That's I'll go back to my Mitch Berman example, right? He had this paper on blackmail, right? Larry Alexander, my former colleague at San Diego, who's a serious criminal law theory person, told me that he thought it was quite a good paper. I said, okay, that got my attention because Larry, really knows this literature. I actually gave the paper first to read to Mark Gergen, your current colleague. Mark, as you probably have already discovered, is a person of very good judgment and sound academic judgment. And Mark read it, and he thought it was a very good paper. His first reaction was, not another paper on blackmail. But in fact, it said something new and interesting, right? And then I read it. And I said, yeah, this is actually quite a good paper, right? That's where you can get a competitive advantage, is if you've got people on your appointments committee who are going to read and can make sort of sound judgments about, the potential.
And do you have a sense of the role of rankings going to something that you've of course specialized in? One question that I have encountered that comes up at some schools is, to what extent should you rely on citation lists to at least get some idea as to who might be underappreciated, or you know, objective criteria generally. That could be a lot of different things. Is the best way to figure this out to just get somebody who's good reading the work saying this is good, or what role should numbers play in that sort of identification of quality?
So I think at the end of the day, you've got to read. Objective indicia like citations are really only useful, they're not useful at the rookie level, right? They are useful at your level, right? And I do, you know, think that I think it does, I think knowing, you know, that somebody's work is very widely cited can be a good reason to look a little more closely, right? And see whether they're being widely cited just because it's a fad or because, gee, no, actually, this work is pretty good and is influencing what other people are doing. Right? I do think these citation studies, which, you know, I started to do, well, actually, the first time maybe about 20 years ago, but then, as you know, the folks at St. Thomas in Minneapolis have kind of taken it over and are doing it more regularly now, and then I spin out of it these lists of the top 10 or 20 in different areas, right? I've seen some indication that there's been some hiring that has probably been influenced by that. I think it is striking that a number of the lateral hires by the University of Virginia Law School this year were rather high up on those lists. And to be clear, I think the University of Virginia Law School was undersold in the overall impact rankings, partly because it's a very big law school. And, you know, and they have Fred Schauer and Doug Laycock, you know, and Ted White, you know, they have some big citation count people there. But it's a big faculty. There are people specializing in a lot of areas. Some areas are low citation areas. That's a crucial thing to understand, right? Constitutional law, high citation field, right? You don't have at least 500 citations in con law, you're a nobody, right? And I'm talking 500 citations in the last 5 years. I'm exaggerating, obviously. You know, tax, if you have 500 citations in a five-year period in tax, I don't know, you're God. It's very uncommon, okay? So you have to make adjustments for that. But, you know, I kind of, you know, Virginia, I think, didn't do as well as they should have done in the overall scholarly impact on the faculty. I think some of their recent hires will change that. You know, is the fact that you've been number one on the crim law and procedure list the last couple of times we did it? I bet that got a few people to take a closer look.
I should say thank you, Brian, for the, or Greg Sisk, if he's doing it now. No, I'm sure that had a significant.
I'm sure I got people to take. You know, people who didn't already know the work probably thought, "Wow." You know, I mean, you know, whether being, you know, so there, you know, were 20 people on the crim law and procedure list, you know. The fact that someone is number 14 rather than number 18, you know, I don't know that that matters a bit. But to be at the very top of, you know, a list where, which is a highly, you know, active field in legal scholarship, I think it's, you know, reasonable for schools to take a look, right? I mean, that's, you know, that ain't nothing. And so I think that it has had some impact on lateral hiring, but that's because it's the objective indicia are a little more meaningful there. You know, there are still, look, there are limitations to the objective metrics. You know, I mean, Arthur Miller is still number one on the civil procedure list. And we know why that is. But people aren't going to hire him, right? You know, despite the fact that the treatise is still there, but he's not really writing it anymore. And, you know, so there can be oddball results on these lists. But I think it's not crazy for schools to keep half an eye on it if they're trying to find, you know, prospects, especially if they have a curriculum need.
Do you have a sense of whether, I guess there's, you know, U.S. News has been considering using Hine Online numbers and incorporating that into, I guess now they're going to have a separate scholarly impact list, but not incorporated into the overall rankings. Do you have a sense of whether those numbers could be or should be used in the overall rankings of schools?
So I predict with a great deal of confidence that US News will incorporate it into the overall rankings within 2 years. And I actually think that would be a good thing, okay? Because we now know, because people have studied this, that the reputational survey of law professors has become an echo chamber for the overall US News rank. So it's no longer giving any additional information, right? The citation counts, the scholarly impact rankings will give more information than the reputational surveys. But I think the reason they are going to incorporate it is because, Bob Morse is a very nice man. I used to talk to him more in the old days, but I don't think he's got terrific judgment. I'll just leave it at that. He loves, but one thing that's clear is he loves objective metrics. They've been introducing them into the medical school rankings, the business school rankings, right? But things they can use in medical schools, like research funding, doesn't mean anything in law schools, right? You know, it's just a fluke if somebody has external research funding. So he likes objective metrics, and he's been finding ways to get them into the other professional school rankings. This is the obvious candidate in law schools, and he is well aware that the reputational surveys have become, you know, kind of just an echo chamber. They're not adding, they're not a separate independent input anymore into the Baroque formula they use. So I'll be very surprised if they don't add it into the rankings in the next 2 years. And I frankly hope they do, because that actually will unsettle things a little bit. And not in a pointless way, right? Some adjustments unsettle things in a pointless way.
A lot of criticisms have been raised about the Hine numbers, or any ranking, of course, is going to be going to have all these arbitrary cutoff problems in terms, especially with Hine, though, with, you know, not counting books and right. all sorts of problems. And do you think those are fair criticisms, or?
I think they are fair criticisms, but my understanding from Ted Sickleman at San Diego, who has been working with US News a bit, which increased my optimism about how this would come out, is that they are working on ways to correct for that. So that, for example, book citations do get recorded. So they are actually trying to get some of these other things into the mix. I hope they will do it. But even if all they can do is, you know, citations to things that are already in the Hine database, it will still be better than 25% of the, you know, ranking being based on people's vague sense shaped by past US News rankings of who's good and who's not. So, but I'm hopeful they are actually going to try to correct for some of these problems from what Ted has told me. And so we'll see. And that will, you know, as with everything, since, you know, the crucial thing about American legal education, as you know, is that it's run by US News and World Report.
Absolutely. I was hoping you could say more about that, because it's one of the striking aspects of legal academia, which being in, you know, I've now been at three different schools, and I will focus on earlier schools because I'm a new arrival at Berkeley, and actually I have not seen this. But at some other institutions, there's a really strong focus on this question, and I've certainly had the impression that, you know, a US News ranking change can end a deanship relatively quickly, and can be something that schools are inordinately focused on. And I was hoping you could talk more about that. Is that rational? Is it just like, what's your take on the fact that like a former magazine is basically the leading force in American legal education, at least within?
Look, it's obviously crazy, right? But that's the system. On the other hand, it's perfectly instrumentally rational for deans to be attuned to this, because the problem is, you know, is very simple, right? Which is that US News doesn't have enough competition. This is actually why I started doing this 20 odd years ago. US News doesn't have meaningful competition. It's not like business schools don't have a US News problem. They don't have a U.S. news problem because, you know, The Economist ranks business schools and The Wall Street Journal ranks business schools. And there's all these other entities, many of which are more credible than U.S. news, ranking business schools. So they don't have to obsess about U.S. news. U.S. news has occupied the field. And as a result, it's had an enormous impact on student behavior. Enormous. You know, there is simply no question that even minuscule changes affect student decisions. And so given that you've got this ranking that's having this enormous coordinating behavior effect on students, right? And most law schools, you know, including Berkeley and including Chicago, need tuition revenue, right? All law schools, you know, are dependent on tuition revenue. There are matters of degree, right? Chicago is less dependent than San Diego, but all of them, you know, need this. They need students and they want students of a certain, you know, academic caliber. They can't ignore it. They can't ignore it. And it doesn't help, right? You know, it's kind of a conspiracy of dumb journalists here because every dopey newspaper and magazine in the country reports the change in the U.S. news rank of their local law schools. And I don't want to be too harsh on journalists, even though I have a pretty low opinion of them as a class. But, you know, I talk to these people sometime and I try to, you know, explain to them that a change, you know, a law school drops in the U.S. news ranking literally means nothing, right? It's got nothing to do with the real world. It means either their competitors cheated more than they cheated in years past, right? Or they just got hit with some piece of stupid bad luck, right? You know, like the central admin took more of their money, so their expenditures went down. Okay, so the changes, in sometimes dramatic, don't actually mean anything, right? But still, they affect behavior, and they affect behavior because the media reports the changes like they mean something, right? So it's just a kind of vicious cycle, and the deans are stuck in the middle of this, and they can't ignore it. They can't ignore it. I'll give you just one example of how completely nuts this is. For a number of years, Chicago was tied with Columbia at number 4 in U.S. News, and then one year Columbia was number 5 and we were number 4. And we got a much quicker yield from the admitted students that year, right? That is, it was a noticeable difference, right? That many more put down the deposit as soon as the rankings came out, right? You know, now, obviously everyone should choose Chicago over Columbia, but that's not what was going on here, right? Deans have to be alert to this because it affects the students that are coming to their school, which affects the finances. And of course, then it can be also a vicious cycle, right? If you slip out of the top 50, right? That makes it all the harder next year to get students to enroll, right? Take UC Hastings. Hastings is a law school that U.S. News, it hasn't destroyed it, but it has damaged it very greatly. You know, when I was a youngster, and probably when you were a youngster too, Hastings was generally recognized as a top 25 law school. However, it's a big state law school in a very expensive area. And for a long time, the U.S. News criteria punished big state law schools in high cost of living areas. And so it started to slip in the rankings. And then a few years ago, it slipped out of the top 50. And a guy at Hastings on the faculty there told me that like one big California firm said, look, this was a Hastings alum. He said, we're not going to be able to come interview on campus anymore. I can't justify that to my partners, right? Yeah. Now, I don't want those listening to take away the message that law firms make their hiring decisions based on U.S. news. It's a myth that they do, except at the margins, right? That is, this was the outcome of a long sort of slide in U.S. news. That's a bad cycle, right? That Hastings got trapped in, right? Now they have a very good new dean and maybe he'll be able to start to turn this around. But then of course it also affects your faculty hiring, right? People see the school slipping, they say, you know, if I'm choosing between Hastings and Davis, right? Now you have faculty who left Hastings to go to Davis. That didn't happen 25 years ago. Davis is smaller. They have generally fared better, and I think they've done a better job managing U.S. News, shall we say. And U.S. News can be managed.
What are some of the strategies? I've seen a little bit of this, but I'm curious your take. I mean, it is one of the extraordinary parts of this system is not only is it a former magazine that is in charge, but it's relying heavily on self-reporting. That's
really self-reported data that they don't audit, right? U.S. News never audits the data.
Right.
So there are the really evil ways that law schools manage or massage the data, right? In the old days, there was, essentially fraud about the employment data. Because it used to be that law schools, so here was a strategy that two very well-known national law schools utilized until U.S. News made it impossible, which was they would take their unemployed grads and offer them a job in the library. If they turned down the job in the library, the law school treated them as not seeking employment and so got them out of the data count. Yeah? If they accepted it, they counted as employed, right? Now, the American Bar Association has changed the reporting requirements, right? I mean, this was the big, probably the most significant change for law schools in the last 20 years was after, who was it? It was Boxer in California. And was it Tom Cotton? No, it was Cotton's, Senator Cotton's Oklahoma. Is that right?
I should remember this.
Yeah.
No.
I think it was Cotton in Oklahoma. It was some senator from Oklahoma. Maybe it wasn't Cotton. They started writing letters to the ABA, right? And you know why these things happen, right? They probably had a nephew or someone who worked in their office who started telling them about what's going on with law school employment data reporting. So the senators sent letters to the ABA and they said, what the heck's going on here, right? There's this fraudulent data reporting. It's totally unreliable. Schools where almost nobody is getting a job that pays six figure are reporting that 90% of their grads, right? And the ABA, letters from senators, right, focused the attention of the ABA. And that's when the ABA changed the reporting requirements dramatically to what we have now, where you have to have, is it a law job? Is it a JD Advantage job? Is it just a job where the JD is irrelevant, right? So that clamped down, but that was the ABA's initiative. That clamped down on one kind of misrepresentation. Here are the things that schools still do that are consistent with the rules. A big thing is to reduce the size of the first year class dramatically and take huge numbers of transfers. The transfers are invisible from the standpoint of U.S. News. Their numerical credentials don't exist. Because all U.S. News cares about is the median credentials of the incoming class. So you shrink the size of the first year class, take a lot of transfers, and or increase the size of the LLM program. Because LLM students don't exist. They don't even exist. They don't even count as part of the denominator for how many students you have in the school that you're spending money on. So you can have a big LLM program, a lot of revenue, but when U.S. News looks at your expenditures, they divide it only by the total number of JD students. They ignore the LLM students. Okay. You get more U.S. News mileage from your median GPA than from your median LSAT because they normalize the scores, right? So, let's say Yale has a median LSAT of 174, right? And, Columbia has like 172 or 173, and it's all normalized, right? So 174 is 100 and so on. It turns out the differentials with the GPAs are much more substantial, right? So that if you raise your median GPA, you get a bigger bump from U.S. News. And this has certainly led a number of law schools to become more GPA heavy than they were previously. I won't name names, but one can figure it out by looking at U.S. News.
And the GPAs are independent of the undergraduate institution and whether it's a
competitive. They're independent of the institution and independent of the major. I mean, well, you also went to Princeton, if I remember rightly.
I did.
Now, you majored in engineering, so they don't have great inflation in engineering. So forget engineering for a second. Princeton has a lot of grade inflation. Princeton, I think, has more grade inflation than a lot of big state universities. That's my sense, okay? But it's also independent of what people study, right? And that's crazy. Look, when I was at the University of Texas, we did a study of UT Austin undergrads who came to the law school and how they did. And what we found actually was that engineering was, a GPA in engineering was an extremely good predictor of success in the law school. A GPA in education was not. we did another study, which is quite interesting. That is, how did the GPA within the major compare to outside the major? The biggest discrepancy, again, was education. You know, people with an A, you know, a 4.0 GPA in education had a much lower GPA outside. People with a 4.0 GPA in engineering had a very good GPA everywhere else, right? I think it's a disaster. I mean, this is where, you know, US News has a really pernicious effect, right? Is that there's this built-in incentive to focus laser-like on the median GPA and ignore the things that actually matter. Like, what did they major in? What kind of school did they go to, right? Is it a notorious grade inflator? Did they have a serious major? Do they have a major that prepares them well for law study, right? And a lot of that gets lost, unfortunately. So that I find rather disconcerting. When I designed law school rankings for a magazine in Canada a number of years ago, they ran them for a few years and then stopped them. But one of the things I said to them was a condition of my helping them was no self-reported data. No input. We're not doing any of that. We're going to do entirely stuff that you can measure. Okay. So we measured things like employment outcomes, clerkships, scholarly impact of the faculties, right, and things like that. And the Canadian law schools complained, you know, Canada's very egalitarian. So the idea that anybody's better than anybody else is already rubbing them the wrong way. But in fact, people told me, Canadian academics, that, you know, the results are actually pretty sensible. I wish U.S. News would get rid of that self-reported data. And especially, I wish they would just, you know, stop with the academic credentials data and use outcome data. This is actually, you know, above the law, which is obviously an appalling cesspool of stupidity in general. But they did take a sensible approach in cooking up their own rankings, right? They don't rely on any self-reported data, right? And they do look at outcomes. Now the outcomes they look at and how they weight them are a little funny, you know. It's all because David Latt, you know, worships the Supreme Court, so they give an awful lot of weight to Supreme Court clerkship. But in a way, I think it's the right idea. And we'd be better off. But U.S. News is very wed to its input data, you know. And so there we are, we're stuck.
Brian, I wanted to address a topic that I've gotten a bunch of emails about from people that are watching the show, which is what is happening with the hiring market for law professors in light of the pandemic? And what should you do if you're a candidate who's in a fellowship, say right now, and you are either planning to go on the market, or I guess now you're on the market, given that the Far Forms just came out, or you're planning on it next year. What is your expectation about what might happen, and what advice would you give to the candidates that are kind of stuck in that position?
Well, so we now have some concrete information, right? Because the first AALS, Association of American Law Schools Jobs Bulletin came out last week. There are 32 schools, I'm just counting the accredited schools, advertising positions. Some of them are advertising multiple positions. And that compares to 78 schools last August. Okay. So there you go, down about 50%, a little more than 50%. There are some schools I know are hiring that didn't have an ad in the jobs bulletin. So there will be a few more. There are schools that, lots of schools, Berkeley included, are operating, unless things have changed, are operating under a hiring freeze, but exceptions could be made. I don't know whether that's Berkeley's current status or not, but a lot of schools are officially hiring freeze, but schools, units can ask to hire in special cases. So in the end, will more than 32 schools be hiring? Probably, but not a lot more, right? So that means that this will be a very tight year. The one thing I don't know is that statistic I alluded to earlier, namely how many people are actually in on the market officially.
I think I saw a blog post this morning from Prof's blog that the number had dropped to 300 or 299, okay. Something like that in the FAR form.
That's good. It was about 380, 390 last year, so it's dropped even further. That's probably because people could, you know, see the writing on the wall that this was going to be a difficult year because so many lost schools can't hire at all because the university finances are in disarray. Everything is hostage to what happens with the pandemic. Fortunately, we have great national leadership on this. Okay. That joke aside, if the scientists and the medical researchers rescue us, the job market may even improve this year. You know, if there's a breakthrough in plasma treatments in the fall, if they start, using a new vaccine beginning in January, this is going to change everybody's mood. It's going to change the economy, right? On the assumption that we have made substantial medical progress by a year from now, some combination of treatments and vaccine, I expect next year's job market will actually come back pretty strong. Because right now everybody's just, you know, they're sitting on the edge, are we about to tip into the abyss or are we about to be able to, you know, go back to something like business as usual? So everything's going to be hostage to that. If God forbid we don't have a vaccine by a year from now, then the tight job market is going to continue, right? Because, you know, as we already discussed, schools are dependent on tuition revenue. Some schools don't have very far to dip into their applicant pool to fill the school. And so for most schools, a hiring decision is the decision about whether the budget can support adding a new faculty member for the next 30 years, right? And that's based on, you know, are students coming? Are they willing to pay, right? Right now, I think schools are doing pretty well in terms of enrollments. I haven't seen a systematic compilation of where we stand for this fall, but the early indications were lots of students are going to law school. That's the flip side of COVID, because there are no jobs, right? The college kids, you know, who were applying for jobs, you know, 9 out of 10 didn't get them, or 4 out of 5, I don't know what the figures really are. So they're going to accept their law school admission, right? So that is going to keep, that's going to be okay for short term, but deans have to think about, you know, how things are going to look going forward. Whether their central administration is going to want a bigger contribution from the law school to university finances, you know, there's all these things, you know, universities are just bleeding money, right? Because they're, you know, not filling their dorms, students are not eating on campus, they're all being sued, as you probably know, various class actions, right, calling for tuition reductions, and, you know, God knows how those are going to play out, so... So we are in the midst of tremendous uncertainty.
Although it sounds like, as you say, it may be things turn around quickly, you know, fingers crossed. Right. But to the extent that that may happen in a year or so, it sounds like, I mean, schools are not going to hold it against any candidates that are, you know, they took an extra year of a fellowship, or maybe they did a 2-year fellowship and did something else for a year. We're hanging out at home. I mean, at least my impression, I kind of want to make sure or see if you agree, is that ultimately schools are going to totally understand this sort of crazy is the wrong word, this remarkable situation, and give everybody, they're not going to hold it against anybody who has done something non-traditional for the year or however long.
That is my expectation. I mean, you know, everybody knows what's happening. Except the guy in the White House. But everybody else in the country, everybody in the Legal Academy realizes what a fiasco this is, right? You know, so yeah, I think, you know, I think even candidates who go on the market 2 years back to back, which is usually not ideal, I don't think it's going to matter this year. I just don't think it's going to be matter. And the one positive thing I do want to say about the jobs bulletin is a lot of the schools that are hiring. I mean, it's not just like, you know, the top 10 law schools are listing, you know, that they're hiring. In fact, only a few of them are in there. There's a lot of law schools that are hiring. I mean, University of Idaho has like three different positions, okay? And that was true even in the depths of the last depression in the academic job market, you know, which followed about kind of 3 years on from the financial crash. You know, even then, there's regional differences that are very important. There are, you know, state flagships. In the depths of the recession, the University of South Carolina Law School hired four people in a single year. They hired very well because it was a buyer's market. You know, so there's a lot of regional variation in how this is affecting schools, and that shows up in the jobs bulletin. The truth is, it's not as bad as I thought it might be. I really wasn't entirely confident. And I'm slightly hopeful that some more schools will actually come into the market or sort of be in the market sotto voce, even though they didn't take an ad. You know, they're going to get the AALS FAR distribution. They're going to look at the files. Maybe since everything is by Zoom, right, being on the market is much cheaper for law schools. You know, you don't have to send four faculty members to Washington, D.C. and pay for their hotel rooms, right?
Right.
So costs have gone down for looking, and, you know, and that's non-trivial for most schools, right? If you can save, you know, $10,000 to $20,000 in your job search, which is what you'll save, it's a lot easier to look. So, but again, I think we're hostage to the medical situation. If there's a breakthrough, that'll be good news for all job seekers. And if not this year, hopefully next year.
Great. Brian, unfortunately, we're out of time, but this has been a fantastic conversation. It's been
thank you all the
insights that I expected and more. And I want to thank you for your leadership on these issues for certainly all the time that I've been in academia. I remember when I started being a professor, people said, "Well, you know, has Brian Leiter said anything about this thing?" And you were I've been a daily reader of your. Of your blogs for many, many years. And and it's always
thank you. That's very, I appreciate that. And I hope it's helpful for your viewers out there. And thank you for doing this whole series. It's, I say, I've enjoyed the ones I've watched and I'm gonna try to get to the others.
Great, thanks so much.
Appreciate you having me. Take good care, bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Legal Academy. If you enjoyed the show, please rate us at wherever you rate podcasts. If you'd like to watch a video version of this episode, you can find it on YouTube at channel The Legal Academy. Finally, you can also follow us on Twitter at The Legal Academy. Thank you.